Welcome to Extremely Live. I am Micah Rock and Roll, and I'm here today with William Ivanez, indie comics artist, a Comics Journal reviewed artist. Pretty exciting stuff. I didn't realize you have a copy of my comic, so that's pretty cool. Because there's a lot of stuff in your comic, Blazing Quantum number one, that I heavily related to. We'll get into that.
But, oh, I appreciate that. Let me show your comic as well.
Heck yeah. Welcome, and thank you so much for doing the show.
Yeah, glad to be here. Yeah, I try to get like a bunch of mini comics from Forbidden Planet anytime I go because they have a good section of indie stuff. So yeah, I have your comic. I've got a bunch of other stuff from there.
Yeah,
it's a good place.
Their indie section is fantastic. It's really, really good. It's like them and Desert Island in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
just reopened. Yeah. I think they're like the only two that I know of, I guess, that like have a pretty involved local and indie section, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But I read your comic. I really, really enjoyed it, and we'll get to that. But what I like to do is I like to just kind of find out how people grew up and where they grew up to kind of get a sense of, you know, what made them and molded them. So I think from your your bio in the back, I believe you grew up in Texas, correct?
Yeah, so, South Texas.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I was born and raised there. It's on the border, right on the other side of Mexico. So the town was originally one town. It was Laredo, Texas. And then after the Americans annexed Texas, they came to Laredo and they divided the town in half.
Wow.
With the river. So mm-hmm. the Rio Grande is like the border officially. And they pretty much told anybody on the northern side of the river was getting annexed and granted American citizenship. Anybody that was on the south side of the rivers belonged to Mexico. So the Mexican side got renamed Nuevo Laredo, which is, you know, you would think like the American side would be called New Laredo because like the original one is just Laredo.
Right.
But yeah, that's, you know, it's just, that's the way history, you know, just tends to happen. And, you know, these names stick. But so I was born and raised there. And then my parents moved there from Puebla, Mexico. And they had settled there pretty much because I think Spanish is still a very dominant language. Like, you know, given that most of the population was Mexican when it was annexed, like it's still very spoken Spanish down there. And they were able to kind of thrive locally and open up a pizza shop down there.
Oh, cool.
So it was like an interesting place to grow up in because it's still like tied to a lot of Mexican culture, but like it's very Americanized in some respects. You know, I grew up with McDonald's and Happy Meals, but also listening to Tejano music, you know, and speaking Spanish outside of school. So it was like a very interesting upbringing.
That's great. I feel like a lot of that is in here in this comic of yours. Like there, you know, the main character works in a restaurant and, you're just bringing back memories from reading this, but that's great. So I also appreciate that you seem to enjoy history or at least have a knowledge of history. There's a segment in this book where we have like this historical interlude of all the happenings throughout the years in the area that the characters live. And it's really, really cool. I love the art of that whole section and just, it was a fun, like excursion away from what you were doing. And then you bring it back. I just really, really enjoyed that. And I thought it was a very cool, interesting thing to do. It felt like, I don't know, like remind me of like a Wes Anderson kind of like tangent almost from like
his movies. I appreciate that.
yeah, it feels like
I wrote that. I still hadn't seen many of his movies because I'm not gonna lie. Like I'm pretty late into a lot of the art films. Like I didn't start watching a lot of art films until probably college or later.
Mm-hmm.
I was just such a comics nerd. I wasn't aware of directors like, oh my God, the guy who just passed away, he did Eraserhead.
Oh yeah, David Lynch, yeah.
Yes, David, like I didn't know anything about David Lynch films. So like a lot of, I appreciate the analogy there. Cause yeah, I didn't grow up watching too many art films. Like, well, I was a total comics nerd. Like that's all I knew.
Yeah.
And then mainstream pop movies, you know, that were like just the top five movies of the 90s, you know?
Right. That's great. Yeah. Let's dig into that. Cause I am always curious. I think, you know, your teenage years are, for whatever reason, that kind of time of your life, when the media and the things you're ingesting kind of really sit in your brain a lot heavier than a lot of other things for some reason. And I feel like a lot of people's influences kind of come from that time, that ultimately shape their own style or their own interests of what they want to make. So I'm always curious what, you know, in your teenage years, what you were consuming. It sounds like a lot of comics, but let's drill down you were taking in.
So my dad's pizza shop, he was just selling pizzas there, and like he had a huge like warehouse for like a lot of the like supplies, and like a couple of kids just asked him if they could start playing like local shows there, because there's no venue for music in my hometown at the time that like catered to the rock and roll stuff. My dad, not knowing any like English or like knowing any American music whatsoever, was like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, like, I'll let you, we split the door and you guys bring me customers.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I grew up around that and as a kid. And like, I remember a lot of the punk rock, like heavy metal people would bring in magazines and comics. So they were bringing comics like from heavy metal, the heavy metal magazine.
Yep.
They're bringing that kind of stuff. They were bringing in stuff like a lot of the Spawn. Spawn was very big with like heavy metal kids for some reason. Like, they were bringing a lot of that stuff in. So I kind of was exposed kind of halfway, you know, in a comics that way. Mm. And then you end up like, oh, there's a comic shop. Like, let me go check. I want to buy more of this stuff. And, you know, I got exposed to like the Marvel stuff there. But I got into it when Image was riding high on their like, you know, grim and gritty post Dark Knight stuff. So like, that's kind of how I got into it. And my dad was like, well, I don't know what this is. I just know the like heavy metal kids are into it. And sure, if you're going to read it, that's so long as you're reading, right. You know, you're learning English and reading in English. That's all that matters. You know, like I'll buy your stuff. So they're very supportive with that. So I did grow up a lot of my time going to the pizza shop on the weekends when they would have shows. I was in eighth grade too. So I was still a little kid, but I would draw in the food area, the dining area. And like, I'd have my sketchbook and like with my comics, and like after the shows in between sets, like heavy metal kids would come out and look at my sketchbook and like, what do you got drawing there? So it's kind of like, I got into comics and punk and heavy metal kind of like, to me, they overlap. Like, they're both major influences in my life. And like, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. Like, they're artistic expressions, right? And they're not considered highbrow art or highbrow music. So to me, they're like, they overlap, and it's kind of, you know, it goes against like the mainstream, you know? And I think comics are anti like high art. Like, they're not mainstream, but then in comics there is a mainstream and an indie. Yeah. And right, so that's pretty funny. And like, so as I got into comics that way, like I started researching a lot. I would go to the library, and there was like a lot of books on comics history, and it was the books on comics history that introduced me to Robert Crumb. And you know, and then from there you find out Daniel Klaus, and then from there like the Hernandez brothers. So it all started because of my dad's pizza shop, like,
that's,
you know,
great, kind
of overlapping. So
as someone who's been hosting a video show out of a wood shop for 2 years, I love the whole kind of non-venue, you know, just taking cash at the door kind of a show. Like, I love that energy. That's great. I want to share this with you because I feel like you would like it. I don't know if you ever read this. This is Ken Lengraf's.
I have some of the single issues, but yeah. I don't have that particular one. He's amazing,
dude.
Amazing.
It's so cool. I just got this because of Jim Rugg just made a, like a zine of some unpublished works by him. And I feel like I had heard of him back in the day, but I just totally forgot about him. I probably through Cartoonist Kayfabe. I feel like they at least talked about him on there, if not interviewed him. But I grabbed this after that zine, and it's the same thing you're talking about, that meshing of like down and dirty art and then like the rock scene. Like everybody in here is, you know, dressed like a punk rocker. And there is this kind of cool, you know, you have to make yourself cool because you're probably a nerd. Like, I feel like that's, you know what I mean? Like that, I bet is true of music. What's that?
It's funny you mentioned that, because I've always told people, I feel like punk rockers are kids that used to be nerds in middle school. Totally. And then to kind of tough up for whatever bullying might come, you turn into a punk rocker. So, you know, it's like peacocking. You look intimidating, so nobody messes with you.
Exactly. Right? So, I think there's some kindred spirit there with the comic book people. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like drawing, well, actually, like...
I think this is funny, or like not funny, but just kind of like self-deprecating. Like, I know for a fact that a lot of the punks that went to these shows were still playing Dungeons and Dragons. They go to Fridays, you go to a rock show, and then like Saturdays, it's like, guys, we're getting ready for like a campaign D&D. You guys want to join? It's like, you know, like, I'm like, what? Like, you guys are so tough. Like, you'd be the last I would think of like being in a Dungeons and Dragons, but. That's it's just, there's that overlap, man. You know, it's that overlap. So it's definitely interesting. I think all this, like the Dungeons and Dragons, punk rock, like Magic the Gathering, to me, it all overlaps. It's like anti-establishment, it's lowbrow, but it's still in your face. You know, and that's the thing too, right? Dungeons and Dragons at one point had the Satanic Panic, right? So even then, like, even if you were a nerd playing that, like, you were still lumped together with the heavy metal music.
Yep.
Right. And it's like, you know, you just got to stick together, I guess.
Yeah.
Against the 80s and 90s overreaction. Yeah. Of the time.
Yeah. I went through that pretty directly in a dark way. Just my family was very like Pentecostal Christian religious. And that whole thing just swept through that whole community of like anything and everything was evil and needed to be, you know, ripped out of your home. And my brothers, older brothers, and my father, I remember had as a little kid remembering them playing D&D at the dinner table, and then they just stopped because of all of that. And I have a very now to me it's funny, but it's a very dark tale of I guess a book came out that was written by Focus on the Family, which was like a big Christian radio station conglomerate type deal, and they said Ninja Turtles were evil, satanic.
I remember that.
And my mom rounded up all my Ninja Turtles and burned them in a bonfire. Oh, like, that's the level of like serious people were taking this back.
Yeah. No, that's traumatizing. I like your story in Orange Flavor. Because you mentioned about, like, you know, the like how religious it was, and that they were you guys were getting the donated clothes, and that the story ends with Jesus. The Jesus Loves You t-shirt that like the rich kid didn't want. So he's like, you guys got it. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I'm like, you know, but like, that's the thing. Like, so yeah, growing up in South Texas, there was a lot of conservative, like, you know, evangelical Christians as well as Catholicism. So like there, you know, I did see a lot of that where like they preach about being like almighty and everything. And then like, oh, look, we're going to donate the clothes nobody likes, like not the good clothes, the bad clothes, right? The taggy clothes. So yeah, it's totally that, man. But yeah. You know, you try your best to navigate it. I was very fortunate that my parents, as religious as they were very understanding of my pursuit of art. But I think part of that is also because I didn't speak English, you know. So they weren't like sitting there reading to see if it was appropriate or not. They're like, well, you're reading for school, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, that's great.
So I guess I did work out in that part. But, yeah, it's, you know, Texas is still very, you know, still got it's religious areas, and every time I meet my folks, I you know, if they want me to go to church, I'll go. I won't. I'll be respectful and mindful, you know.
I'm curious, were you drawing before you got into comics, or was comics the thing that
No, I was. And I actually, I loved watching cartoons as a kid. Like, you know, I'm a Transformers, Ninja Turtles, Thundercats kid. And I like was like, I want to do that for a living. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to get into animation. And then as I got older, I'm like, wait a minute, you got to draw, like, one scene takes a couple of months. Like, you got to draw like 30 to 40 pages for 2 seconds. I'm like, that seems boring. I'm like, I'm like, you know, one punch, it takes like, you know, like 30 drawings. I'm like, I can't draw 30 pages in like one day. I'm like, that's boring. So I was like, oh, comics is like, you can pretty much do it by yourself. You don't need a team of animators. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember trying to get my brother to draw with me. I have a younger brother who's like a year apart. And I remember trying to get him to draw with me. Like, me thinking in my head, like, we're going to have an animation team. Like, let's draw together. It's like, no, man. These like, animation studios, like, have, like, 80 people at least, you know. Like, so, yeah, comics, I got into it. And then, like, you know, you research that. And it's like, you know, all it takes is, like, one person, maybe three, inker, colorist, letterer, four, you know. And like, I started making mini comics probably around eighth grade, somewhere around there. Like, I just remember having a comic fall apart and like the staples falling off the spine. And I'm like, oh, this is like, these are spreads. This is how you have to fold it. I'm like, well, I can do this, you know? And then it's like, you just get your mom's stapler and like staple a couple of sheets and then just draw my own stories. And then like just show them off to people at school. And that's kind of what kind of pushed me towards that direction. And they were comics that were like, I was just making stick figures, like funny stories, and like getting people to laugh at that was like, all right, man, I can do this. This is, people are liking it. And I had one copy. I remember this. I had one copy. I lent it to one of my friends, and they ended up losing it. And I think like 3 days later, some kid came up to me in the hallways, was like, hey man, you gotta check this out. It's funny. It was like all toilet humor too. It was like middle school toilet humor, like probably my bad attempt at Beavis and Butthead. But like they handed it back to me and they're like, this is hilarious. It was like all wrinkled, like pages that were tearing, but they're like, I don't know how many hands I had been through. And I'm like, this is mine. I'm like, can I take it back? Like, well, I have to give it back to the person who lent it to me. I'm like, where'd you get it from? I'm like, this is mine. I'm like, give it back to me, you know? But that's, I was like, awesome. Oh my God, like the whole, like half the school must have read this. I'm like, I was like, even though it was like torn and everything, I was like, yeah, man, I can do this. This is fun. I want to pursue this as a living or a career. So yeah, that's kind of what, like, you know, did it for me, is like, I'm going to pursue it.
That's great. I love that you got a genuine compliment. He didn't even know you were the one who made it. And he's just like, you got to check this out. That's a great story.
Yeah, thanks.
I like to kind of dig into that. There's always just something interesting from that era in people's lives, you know, like I like to start there. But let's start talking about Blazing Quantum specifically. Was this your first like serious comic, or when did your first, like, you know, like, I'm charging money for this, I believe in this, this is my first thing. Like, when did that come about?
I think by college, I was trying to kind of quote unquote break in. Mm-hmm. In art school, there were two clubs. There's one called Ink Stains. There was one called Cartoon Allies. And the school was sponsoring the club to like pay for tables at SPX.
Oh, cool.
And, I got a table at one show with a couple of like classmates, and I was like, this is it. I'm going to sell my comic and I'm going to really try my best at this. And I remember working like for a whole semester on the story, and I just sold one copy. this show, and I was like, man, I felt so disheartened, because I remember Alex Robinson was there, who did Box Office Poison.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm tabling at a show with professionals. I'm like, people are here to buy comics. I'm gonna sell all my print run. I went to Staples and hand stapled them. And I must have done 50 copies. And I went. We got in the bus to Maryland, because it's still in Maryland. But yeah, me and a couple of students got on the bus to Maryland. And I had my box of comics, and I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, no, I sold one copy, and I was just so disheartened. And the only highlight of the show was I might as well go try to talk to all these creators, showing my portfolio and my samples and my mini comic. But Alex Robinson's the one I remember the most, just being like, "No, man, that's amazing! You're not gonna." You got to fail first before you make your make it big. You're not going to sell out of the first comic you make. No one comes out of school a professional. It takes trial and error. And I told him, I read your comics in eighth grade. And he's like, what? He's like, I'm not that old. And so I bought one of his comics and he signed it. One day someone's going to tell you they read your comics in eighth grade. And I was like, that's awesome. I got to meet Alex Robinson. And I knew who he was because he got a shout out in Wizard. Wizard back then used to have, or the early Wizards, they used to have the column dedicated to independent comics. Mm-hmm. So that's why I knew Alex Robinson. So I have to go talk to him. So that was the only highlight of the show. I was super sad. And then Alex Robinson kind of lifted my spirit. So when I went back home, I was like, this isn't the end of the world. You gotta take your rejection, man. So Blazing Quantum was kind of my after college, this is going to be my first issue book. And I made it 2006. I graduated 2005. So I'm in around 2006. And I tried chopping it to diamond. I tried to get a couple of my art professors to give me blurbs. And nobody was biting.
Damn.
It's pretty depressing. Mm. And I had a whole proposal for Diamond and they rejected it. And I had it professionally printed. I had it in color too. And it just didn't happen. And I was like, well, you know, I got to try something else or try to find another career. So I went back to school for graphic design and, I ended up getting a job in that field. And when my ex got pregnant, I was going through my old stuff, my old art school drawings, and I'm like, this doesn't look bad. I'm like, I came across it. I'm like, Blazing Quantum doesn't look bad. I'm like, I don't know, man. And she was pregnant, and I was like, man, if I don't submit this to more people or try again and just maybe re-letter it somehow, I'm gonna regret it. It's either now or never. So I sent it out to the Comics Alternative. Rest in peace. They were around for a few years, but I think one of the hosts passed away not too long ago. But they reviewed mostly graphic novels and and it was not superhero stuff. Mm-hmm. And I sent them I made it into a mini comic, black and white. I took out the color. I sent it to them on a whim, and I was like, if they so much as look at it, then I'll try again. And a couple of months went by and they gave me a good 2-hour review on the show.
That's awesome.
They broke it down and everything. And I was like, that's it. I'm doing this. I'm like, maybe Diamond, because Diamond at the time, we all know they used to be a monopoly, right? They're going through bankruptcy now. But back then, if you wanted to get into comic shops as an independent creator, that was the end all be all. Diamond had the final say. And if they said no, your only other option was to table at shows, right? And even then, if you're not a well-known name, some of these shows, they had a lottery or it's curated. And if you're not a name like Daniel Klaus or Scott McCloud, it's very hard, you know? So when they got on the show, when I got reviewed on that show, it was kind of doors opened and it kind of put me on the right track. You got to keep doing this. So I made issue 2, then 3. But it took a while, man. Like, yeah, it's, that was 2006 when I made Blazing Quantum, and I would say only in the last like 5 or 6 years has it been getting like reviewed and attention. And like, I've been going to shows. I've been to SPX 3 years in a row. I just did a book fair like 2 weeks ago, and it feels really good, man. Like that people are recognizing it, because yeah, it's been a struggle. Like it sat on the shelf for a while.
Yeah,
you know. So
yeah, it's. I mean, I'm only just getting started in the past few years of taking the comics thing more seriously, and it wouldn't shock me if most people in comics have a day job. You know what I mean? Like even the professionals, I feel like, I'm sure, like, have a teach a class or something along those lines, just because it's hard to make a hit. And especially in the world of comics, which I would imagine is pretty small compared to other art forms, like you know, film, although even film is like shrinking now, like
because it's all mainstream stuff. Like you can't see a good indie film in a theater anymore. Like I know during college when I was like getting exposed, like I said, to a lot of the independent films, like I know you know, we had Film Forum and a couple of those theaters, but like you don't see, it's very, you don't see as much as the smaller films making it to like the big theaters. Like they have to compete with all the like genre superhero stuff that I'm already tired of.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if a movie like Fight Club would get made today or like, cause that's like my, like, that's where I'm going by. Like Fight Club wasn't the genre movie, it was based on a book. Right. And like that, and as some people might find that movie problematic, but like when it came out for me and like my friends, I'm like, wow, this is like very, it's an eye opening like film. Right.
I started a Fight Club as a 16-year-old because of it.
Wow.
Do what you don't do. You get broken teeth real fast.
Yeah. But I mean, like that whole book was a critique on capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like the failures of capitalism and like just commercialism. And for that film to come out in a mainstream like release, like was pretty amazing. Like, especially if like you're a teenager and like it does make an impression. And I feel like those types of movies you're not going to see anymore, you know, which is unfortunate.
They're definitely far and few between. I know a guy here in New York who just sold a comedy to Hulu. So it's still, you know, possible, but it's like, it's absolutely less common to see somebody's like independently made, you know, small movie. Like it's just rarer and rarer for whatever reason. It doesn't make any sense to me, really. Like, why do all movies have to have a budget of $200 million in order to get into a theater? I don't understand why that is. Why can't you, you know,
I feel like it's affected all art forms, like trying to go back to comics, right? But I think technology really changed how, whether it's comics, film, or music, the way like society interacts or consumes media has completely changed. And like, I think as a result, we're getting smaller returns as artists, regardless of what medium you're in.
Yeah.
I think it's unfortunate because, you know, you used to think like, oh, well, even if you don't, like, not all art forms are going to give you money, but if you make it in Hollywood, you'll probably get some money, right? Mm. And, like, that's not true anymore. Like,
yeah, I know. Like, it's writers insane.
Writers are not getting paid like what they used to, right? And it's like, wow, man, if like, Hollywood's struggling, I can't imagine how harder it's going to be for cartoonists.
Yeah.
You know, or like, yeah, streamers. It's crazy. But I think social media did change how we interact with art a lot. Yeah. And, like, we're having to adapt to that, and like I don't know if it's gonna get better, but I think we're in that like stage in our technology, our relationship with technology, where we're figuring it out, like how can this be sustainable. I don't know. I know musicians, like, how many cents do they get per Spotify song? Like, it's, you know,
Not much. I mean, just the fact that A-level celebrities all do commercials now. Like, my wife is an actor and goes out for commercials all the time. And I'll hear her reciting lines in here, and then 6 months later, you know, some woman from SNL is saying them in the real commercial. And I'm like, and not even just SNL, like Julia Roberts, like doing a coffee commercial or something. Like, it's because they're not making as much money as they used to. And they, like, you know what I mean? They have to keep up that lifestyle that they're accustomed to from the 90s or whatever. And so now they all do commercials, and now regular people, it's even harder to just book a commercial as an actor, because, you know, if Brad Pitt's willing to do a commercial, you're going to hire Brad Pitt to do it. It's pretty wild. I do think a lot about the distribution side of things, like how that there's got to be more people out there interested in independent stuff than can find it. You know what I mean? Like you as a little kid were discovering all this cool stuff because it was physically in front of you. And like, you had like these, you know, you had like the Big Brother character of the metalhead kids showing you like heavy metal and comic books and stuff. I had my older brothers showing me cool stuff. And my grandfather actually was a big comic guy and showed me a lot of very cool comics. Like, we need that like voice or the distribution system where people can find the cool stuff. And it just, I don't know. I'm not sold that it's social media, you know, like, I think that it could be if they would show you the stuff that you told them you wanted to see rather than.
You know, but that's the thing. I feel like everything's so like catered to a specific audience now. Like, you can't, that's the thing with social media. You can't randomly bump into a Daniel Klaus post or a Robert Crumb post if you're not already looking for that, right?
Yeah.
Like, I know, like, you used to be able to go to a comic shop and, like, you could randomly pick something off, like, you know, an Hernandez Brothers comic and, like, oh, that's cool. Like, what is this? You pick it up out of curiosity, right? And then, like, it blows your mind, you know? And now it's... I'm glad about for the comic shops we have up here, because they do tend to like diversify their product. But if you go to like smaller towns, they can't afford they can't afford to order that much product because their populations are smaller, right? So the smaller towns have like smaller populations, so like they can't order as like many diverse things. And so the stores like in Texas where I used to shop, I tended to be mostly Marvel and DC. And if you wanted something like a Love and Rockets comic or Daniel Klaus, you'd have to drive 3 hours to like the metropolitan city, right? So I don't know what's going to happen with the Diamond bankruptcy. I know they dropped, like, the people that are suffering the most are like the smaller publishers, the independent publishers, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think comic shops are probably going to have to run themselves the way bookstores do, right? And bookstores, everything they can order and it's still returnable. And I think that's kind of what did it for comic shops or for the comic book industry, right? That you buy everything like and you have 30 days to pay it back, it's not returnable. And I think that was a good business for publishers, and like even for independent publishers it worked for a while. But I think, you know, that was kind of the nail that like kind of, you know, hit the coffin. It was just that it was that model that like it wasn't sustainable. So I think if comic shops are going to survive and like still be able to carry diverse product, they need to kind of restructure themselves the way bookstores do, I think. But who knows? I don't know. I'm like, it's just something I was thinking about, because, you know, going back to mini comics and how do we get it in front of stores, like, yeah, I had submitted to Diamond, and then I thought about like, well, if Diamond's not going to take it, the only other places are bookstores. But bookstores, you need to have it collected as a graphic novel, right? And it's like, I don't have enough pages done for that. And do they carry periodicals? And like, well, yeah, they carry periodicals, but that's a different barcode, because it's you know, I researched all this back then, and I'm like, you know, it's just trying to find a way that's like sustainable and still be able to be profitable. And, you know, I like what you said earlier, like a lot of cartoonists do have day jobs. These it's something that keeps me up at night, like for sure, you know, and I'm very fortunate that I've been getting the press I've been getting the past 5 years, but it's not to the point where I'm like, oh, I can quit my day job.
Right. Yeah. It's tough. I don't know where people are looking for things anymore, you know, like even if you follow, like someone follows you on Instagram, there's like a huge chance that they'll never even see anything you post because the algorithm just shows you other random crap too. So it's like, I don't know. I think the algorithms are the enemy of the small creator for sure. Like they're kind of hiding what you're making. So it's like, how do you build your audience and get in front of them consistently it's a big issue. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. Like you're saying, even like on a comic book shop level, we're going to have to start experimenting and changing things and trying things. And I don't know what that looks like, but I mean, I keep telling myself I'm going to do this and I haven't yet. And I really should, but I am straight up like just kind of for fun and experiment, want to go down into the New York City subway and just literally just hawk comic books.
Like,
you know what I mean?
That's some of mine too, like Robert Crumb style when he was selling his comic out of the baby carriage on San Francisco.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you kind of have to push it. I there's a grocery store across from my house and I had them carrying my comic for nice. And it was awesome. Like it felt great. Like I'm like this, there are things you can do, and like you just have to kind of think outside of the norm, and like, you know, what kind of a store would be interested in having a comic book for sale that isn't necessarily a comic shop, like that I think is a good thing for people to think about for their, like, anywhere you live, like someone will be charmed by the idea and be willing to. Often what I was doing is like, you know, you don't have to pay for them. You can just hold them. And then if you sell, I'll check back, you know, in a couple weeks. And if you sell, we'll split the profit. Like that gets you in the door at the very least. But yeah, there's a lot of creative thinking has to be done. I think, unfortunately, it's not just the fun of making stuff. Like if you want to actually get in front of people, you got to think, I guess like a business person, which is not my greatest skill, but, you know,
I don't think comics are going to go away. I mean, I definitely do agree that like people are craving this stuff. They just don't know it's out there. Right. So
totally.
I think book fairs and comic festival, like zine festivals, you know, like those, I've been fortunate to already be in some of those, and like, it's, you know, people respond. So there's that, but like, yeah, I mean like how like, and that's the thing too, right? Like, yes, festivals are awesome, but like, you can't be touring the whole country and then like expect that to be like profitable. Cause you got to pay for gas and food and like, you know, all that stuff. But yeah, that I did think about. I'm like, well, what if I tour like a rock band? Like, just get a band and we do every show from like the east to the west coast for one summer. Like, table at every show and just drive and tour. But it's like, yeah, you got to pay for gas and like, what about hotels? And like, so like the costs do add up. But I was like, I could just tour it like a punk rock band.
I mean,
like,
that sounds fun just to do. You know what I mean? Like, if you were. If the goal wasn't making money, like that just sounds like a fun, thing to do, you know, like get a, one of those van life vans and sleep in your
van. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, this first issue is 64 pages. That to me is extremely impressive as someone who's, I think thus far I think I've topped out at 10 pages for a story. I do an anthology, so I just do a bunch of smaller things and put it all together. But I am kind of building up to, you know, longer and longer stories, and I want to get to like sort of a Japanese manga one shot length. I think that would be a fun goal. But yeah, I guess this is like, I would say it's almost a graphic novel in a single issue. Like why did you decide to make something so long? But like that to me is interesting. Like rather than do like a 24 page thing over a period of time, like you put a lot into this thing.
Well, yeah, they were designed as like 8-page vignettes.
Okay.
And I decided to like tie them together. Like there's a thread that ties all the vignettes together, right? Because they're like, I think they're 8-page increments.
Okay.
And the reason I designed them that way is because I was thinking of the Two-Fisted Tales and the EC comic format, like 8-page stories that like you can take a break at and then pick up again later. And it's another story. And like, I kind of designed it that way because I really liked Harvey Kurtzman's like take on things, right? Like it was easily digestible. And my thinking was like, well, I want to create this like huge thread with history and like the biography of the hometown. Like, I don't call it autobiocomics. I call them a metabiography because it's not just me. It's like the history of the town. So I was trying to kind of find a way to like weave all that together. And I was like, well, Harvey Kurtzman like had like his comics that like were like anthologies, right? But like they still had a theme. It was like they were either war related, Two-Fisted Tales or horror, like the EC comics or humor, the Mad before it was a comic, I mean a magazine. And they were all 8-page stories, but like the theme was the same. So I'm like, okay, like the theme for me is that like it's like history, but it also like affects like the teenagers that were growing up there. Like, so I figured the format from Harvey Kurtzman would work great. And I'm like, let's just see how many stories I can get together and see how long this thread can weave through these 8-page like shorts. And it came out to 64 pages. And it just, I don't want to say I planned it. I feel like it just kind of fell in place like a happy accident, you know, but it was definitely me thinking in Harvey Kurtzman terms. And I'm like, okay, the theme of the book, okay, it's not Two-Fisted Tales, it's not horror, but it's a biography, but it's not my biography. So that's the theme. It's biography, but of what? And it's like me, but history and like Texas. And it's like, okay, that's biography is the theme. Let's tie all those things together. 8-page vignettes. And it came out to 64 pages.
That's great.
But yeah, I'm glad you kind of pick up on some of those things, because it's you don't know if it's gonna be successful when you're planning this out, you know. You're just kind of like, I don't know if it was just me being naive or just overly ambitious not knowing any better, but it's just, you know, like, all right, let's go for it and see how it comes along. What made it easy for me was thumbnailing everything in 8-page increments. And like, you know, I didn't have the whole 64 pages planned out. It was 8-page thumbnails, draw 8 pages, ink 8 pages, thumbnail another 8, and like see if the pieces fit. And yeah, it did take a while though. It wasn't like a year. I think it took about a year and a half or two to get all that together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of work. That's smart of like doing it in those increments. And yeah, it would be overwhelming if you were like, I'm going to do a 64 page epic, you know what I mean? And like, just start from one and plan out every page to 64.
That is insane to me. And you know what? When I've tabled at shows, sometimes I do talk to professionals. And like, I know Joe Flood, who's done stuff for Scholastic. Like I was talking to him about how he works, and he's like, man, if you're doing a graphic novel for these big publishers, they don't even want you penciling or inking a page, like before they see the whole thing thumbnailed out.
Whoa.
I do not know if I can do like 200 pages worth of thumbnails to get an approval to start inking or penciling.
Yeah, that's brutal.
I'm like, I'm ready to start drawing, and if like, if I have to pitch something and I have to show thumbnails first, like 100 or 150 pages worth of thumbnails is just, I get bored. Like, yeah. I don't, yeah, my thumbnails are stick figures, you know?
Yeah. I don't have like a set, like, order of way I do things. Like, the ideas come to me in different ways. So it's like, sometimes I'll start drawing first, or sometimes I'll start writing, you know, on the computer first, or I'll draw without knowing what the dialogue is yet and then figure it out later, you know?
Yeah. So I'm the same way. It's just kind of like, and I think cause we're cartoonists, we like tend to think, we don't think with a script, and we don't necessarily think with drawings. We just, you know, it's, we think sequentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a different way of thinking than like writing a script or writing a book. And it's a different way of thinking from observational drawing, or like doing like the structure of the human form. Like, you know, it's cause it's such a different way. And it's like, you know, I've tried to tell the like people who are illustrators, like, well, how do you plan a page? Like, do you like get the anatomy? And like, no, man, it's like, that's like, no, like there's, like, I'm thinking about like maybe film, if anything.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Me too, actually. Like, the way I think of them is, at least for the issue I'm working on right now, is they feel like short films to me. And they're like, the scenes kind of operate as scenes in a short film. Like, it has a very much a flow like that, which I know some people are like, that's lame. Like, comics can be their own thing. And like, you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely that energy out there, which I respect. I do. I do get that. And, but for whatever reason, yeah, it's been coming to me as like scenes in a film. And it's like, these are like the key frames of,
scenes, you know? I think people don't realize timing is just as important for film as it is for comics.
Mm. Yeah.
Or vice versa. Cause like you gotta know when to hold a pause or when to like zoom in on a character's face, you know, and just kind of like, you know, pause for the like somber moments. Like, and those are two things that are important for both mediums, like just timing.
Yeah.
So you can get the laugh, or you can get like the, you know, the tears from like your audience. Like, yeah, it's a different way of thinking. I think like cartoonists like tend to be like a different breed of artists that like I don't think are as understood as much. I don't know. I'm not saying cartoonists are like highbrow, but I think, like we tend to be like I don't know, like our way of processing thought and like thinking and imagery is just, it's completely different than like your average, not average. I shouldn't say average. I'm not talking bad about film and authors or writers, but it's just a different way. It's just, you know, and I think people get frustrated sometimes with like our process, and, you know, and sometimes I bring that type of thinking to my job too, like to my graphic design job. And I'm like thinking different ways than from how my coworkers are, or processing information differently. You know, you get your design brief or your like art instructions from your art director, and like I'm like processing things differently from my coworkers, and I'm, it's just, you know, we're a different breed. So
you talking about timing, you just made me remember how much I appreciate the sort of the Japanese manga style of like they'll have these frames of just like leaves falling or something, or these panels, you know what I mean? Like these breathing moments. Was it Osamu Tezuka? Is that, I always say his name wrong.
Yeah.
Osamu Tezuka. Yeah. Like, I love Dororo. I don't know if you've ever read that, but it's a good one. It's worth checking out for sure. But like, it has these nice moments where you know, they make the point they're trying to make, and we see something that's just like scenery or like a close up of something, and then we move on to the next moment. Yeah, you just made me think of that. Not that there's
any... a lot of great timing in there.
For sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of techniques and how we do things, I just want to compliment you on your spotting of blacks, as they call it, where you're filling in, shadow in these beautiful, huge, swaths of black. I'm assuming you took some inspiration from the Hernandez brothers, because I see them as kind of kings of that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm pretty blown away by the Hernandez brothers, to be honest. I haven't read enough of their stuff, but just because I would love to get like Love and Rockets in sequential order, like as either the just like a single issues, but it's so expensive. So I started grabbing those, these things, the compilations.
Yeah. Those are great. Yeah.
And they are good. But yeah, it reminded me of that, of like,
oh, thank you.
I
don't think I'm nowhere near that, but I appreciate it.
None of us are, but I don't know. Like you've got a lot of like heavy, black on the page. And it's a skill I do not have, and I'm trying to work on it. And I just really appreciate that. And I'm curious, like, when do you see, like, at what point are you seeing that and knowing it's going to be, like a harsh, super harsh shadow? Like, are you kind of experimenting after the fact and finding it, or are you nailing it down? Do you have to nail it down first before you know how the rest of your composition is going to look? Like, just tell me a little bit about.
I usually, my pencils are very light. I don't think about light and shade during the pencils. My pencils are just like the outlines of the characters in the backgrounds. And then I figure out all the shadow in the inking stage. I'm not going to lie, man. It's like a lot of push and pull. Mm-hmm. Like, well, if I put a black here, then that means I can't put a black in front. So like, I kind of have to be like, okay, well, if the black's there, then that means the shirt, even if the character shirt's black, I have to kind of leave some white and to kind of balance it out. Right. So it's like a push and pull. It's like what making stuff pop, right? And if it's a character by himself and like he looks very empty, then like, all right, just black out the background or like add shapes or forms that you know go black to fill in. Like an inker that I really looked at a lot was Wally Wood. I think he's probably the master of inking, and like I think the comic books look the way they do today because of his like light and shading. I always tell people they should check Wally Wood out. And I'm not going to lie, like, sometimes, like, I can't figure it out. Like, I will have a Wally Wood comic next to me as I'm inking, and it's like, you know, like, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I'll be like, I can't figure this out, and, like, I want to make this character pop, but, like, he's in front of a window, and then, like, I'll pull up the Wally Wood book or comics. I have his 22 panels that always work somewhere up here.
Oh, that's a good – I'm writing that down. I've heard of that, and I never thought to grab it.
But yeah, his 22 pounds that always work. And if you get any of his black and white comics, it's just any of that stuff like really helps. Even if you have it on the side while you're like drawing.
That's cool. It's something that's a good tip.
Yeah.
I just grabbed, it's like the best of the EC stories, artist edition or whatever. And I'm pretty sure there's some Wally Wood in there. I would imagine.
Those are good. So wait, you have the big one, the 11x17 ones.
It's not quite. It's like somewhere in between. But yeah, cool. It's the pictures of the actual boards. So I'm excited to. I haven't cracked that open yet. I'm excited to go in there. Yeah, man. It just always looks so good to me when there's just like those. Super just tons of like super dark shadows. I love that look, and I'm always gun shy to like do it on the page. I've been experimenting in Photoshop after the fact. I'll like do black fills and see how it looks and kind of play around, but my default is always to like hash, or if something feels like too plain, I'll just start like stippling a little bit here and there to like just fill in some detail, which I still like, but like I definitely want to incorporate more of that. Yeah, like I said, just like that super stark. I love the stark contrast. It just looks awesome. And I rarely do it. So I'm going to push myself to do more of that. And I will take your advice. I'll have some Wally Wood out as I do it. That's good. Let's see what else. We're getting to the hour mark. I usually wrap up around there, but let's see what else I've written down here. I do want to compliment you on, I was looking at your, what is it called? Here it is. Codex of the Jaguar. I was like flipping through the images online, and those character designs are awesome, dude. Like they look great. It's so cool. I'm going to grab a copy of that for sure.
Thanks.
Yeah. Like the whole look of the characters is just awesome. I wrote down some themes and things that stood out to me in Blazing Quantum. One of them was violent adults just getting swatted all the time or spanked. It's a different time, folks, but I had a similar experience.
It's that conservative Catholicism, in my case, like the conservative Catholicism upbringing, right? Like, you know, and I'm sure it comes from like, it just comes from years of like colonialism and like the Spaniards bringing in like this very strict moral Catholic code, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like habits that get passed down. But I mean, that goes as far back as the nuns hitting people with the ruler, and you know, it's just stuff that I grew up around. But like, you know what, like now that I'm older, like me and my brother will like kind of laugh about it, because it's like, you remember that time you really like pissed off mom and like she lost her shit, and it's like, oh my god, you were crazy for like thinking that, like, you know, we laugh about it, but like, you know, it's like, yeah, you can't, you know, like it's definitely something that is problematic, right? You shouldn't be. I don't advocate that you raise your kids that way, but it's just like, I think for us, like, I guess people in my generation, or at least people in my generation that are from my background, like, we tend to use humor to kind of overcome, like, I don't want to call it trauma, but like we use humor now to kind of overcome and like,
It soothes things. Like,
like, you
anytime
know,
I'm in a situation where it feels like there's conflict or like brewing anger, my immediate impulse is to like make a joke to like try and like ease the tension. So I 100% understand where you're coming from. I'm the same way. Like, probably not a good thing to do, but I also don't want to be like, you know, like you were saying, like trauma, quote unquote. Like, I don't want to be the person going around complaining about how traumatized I am. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And it's like, I think there are other worse ways to like raise your kids. Like, I think
totally.
Like, my parents were still very supportive of my career. They were very, like, but both of them, like, you know, put me in art school, like, from our private art classes when I was a little kid.
That's awesome.
They had no problems when I went to college. If I wanted a spawn book, they said okay. Like, they would only lose their tempers when it was, like, you know, you were doing what? Like, you were, like, drinking, like, with your friend, like, you know. Stuff that is like, I should not have been doing that, you know. Like, you know, I remember in college, I was the only Hispanic in, I think, on my floor, and my two roommates, very American. And I was just like nonchalantly like, yeah, man, I got caught drinking, like, or me and my brother got caught drinking or something. And my mom like smacked us, and like she lost her shit, and like we thought it was funny, and like, you know, just shit happens. And my roommates were like, wait a minute, your mom hit you with like with a sandal, like the chancla? Like, dude, that's wrong. And I'm like, whoa, like, what do you mean? I'm like, dude, like, you know, I'm like, I everybody was Catholic where I grew up. I'm like, you know, this is just pretty, I hate to say it, but it was pretty normalized.
Yeah.
You know, growing up.
We got the wooden spoon when we were acting up.
Yeah, no, I didn't get that. Seems more painful.
I don't know. You have images of the belt, and I would imagine the belt's pretty bad.
A wooden spoon's like, it's hard. It's like, you know, it doesn't flap. I'm like imagining how much worse that is.
No.
But yeah, it's like, you know, we do, like, I deal with it by like laughing, and sometimes like people are like, well, like that's some people that did go through that, like they're traumatized by it. Yeah, and like, you're not. And like, how do you why do you process it that way? And again, I think it's just a way of like survive. I don't know if it's surviving or just, you know, like we use humor, man. And like, again, it goes back to being cartoonists. Like, we just process life and things differently because of our tendency to want to look at comics for escapism. And some comics are hilarious, some comics are funny, and it's just the way we process stuff, you know. I don't know, it's just something that I think about, because there I have met other people here that like who have gone through very traumatic abuse,
yeah,
and they're very scarred by it. But it's like, well, I don't feel like I was scarred. Like I my parents are still very loving.
Yeah,
my parents very supportive. And then like, to me, abuse that's more traumatic would be like neglectful parenting, or, you know, drinking and like not making dinner, like, you know, like me, that's much more like abuse, right?
There was nothing like sadistic about it, you know what I
mean? Yeah,
like I agree with you, it's probably not great, but it's like, it's not the same thing as like you're saying, like clearly from an evil place abusing a child, there's quite a difference. But I also understand people being like, what the fuck, that's how you grew up? Yeah, like I've also gotten similar reactions of just like horror. It's like, I don't know, I turned out all right as far as I know.
Both make comics, so
The other thing I really, really resonated with and appreciated was kind of goofing around with coworkers to like make the best of a shitty job that you're like not wanting as a teenager. And like having someone at work who you like hanging out with was great. Like that just, it took me back to being, you know, 16 years old, working at a pharmacy in my town and meeting a bunch of friends. Make a lot of friends that way when you're young, I think. At least I did at my like day jobs.
Absolutely. And that's the thing too, though. It's like, I wasn't always working with people I got along with, because sometimes you would work with people you don't want to be with.
Yeah, that also happens. Yeah, that's
and then if their family, like, you know, they can't fire you know, your cousin who was hired, like, because they're doing a favor to an act, like, they, you know. And if you don't get along with them, it just makes it so much worse, and you have to learn how to tolerate each other, right? It's navigating people, it's learning how to navigate around like problematic people too, right? Like, it's just trying to be patient and understanding, but also like, yo, am I being exploited by being here? Like, you know, like, is this exploitation? As much fun as I had working there, like, yeah, sometimes there were days where I was like, we'd be at each other's throats, you know, like, you fucked up an order, and it's like, no, I didn't, like, I wrote it correctly, why am I getting blamed? You need to make this plate because the customer's yelling at me.
I can only imagine the, like, because your family, the like the extra level of like comfortability of like being like that fuck you energy.
Like, you know, because you know each other, you can tell each other off. You know, and then you get home like after the work day, and like you're all sitting at dinner, and like you have to let that anger go and just be like, all right, man, I'm sorry. Like, you know, it's like, listen, we're both working tomorrow again, like at the same place. You know,
that's awesome.
Man,
I just keep thinking back to your father letting basically a music scene develop, and that's just so cool. I love here in New York. You know, I've put together a lot of video shows over the years, and I try and have that sort of DIY feel. It's always much more fun. It's always feels like there's more of a community when it's like you're just kind of scraping by and figuring it out. We had to move to a real venue because the wood shop we were at, they've just gotten like very busy and they can't do the shows as often. So we had to like take some time off and find a real venue. And like, I'm excited about it. Cause it's like such a huge upgrade and like the projector and the sound system. And like, it's going to be like a real show now. And that's exciting. But on the one hand, I'm like, man, I liked that we were in a wood shop and like everything was a little bit shitty. Like I like that vibe.
Yeah. Those shows can be a little more intimate, but you know, the space is good. It just means more people can come.
That's true. It's true. Well, this was really great talking to you. I really enjoyed Blazing Quantum. Everybody should grab a copy. It's a hell of a deal. You know, it's a great price for 64 pages. I read it over multiple sittings, so there's a lot in there to digest and enjoy. I'm excited to check out your Luchador one as well. That looks super cool. Just the character design alone is sucked me in. I have
these are also sweet. At Forbidden Planet. Codex of the Jaguar, written by Mario Martinez. It's my first time working with a writer.
Oh, cool.
The script, so you know,
that's awesome. I've yet to brave bringing in another element yet. Well, I'm building up to it.
Well, you know what? When I bought this one, because they were like, you know, I was looking through when I bought it, I'm like, oh, this looks like it's 8 different people drawing it. And like, when I picked it up off the shelf, I'm like, oh, table of contents, different cartoonist. I'm like, awesome. And when I finished it, I'm like, wait, is this all the same dude? Like,
yeah,
it's pretty impressive.
Oh, thank you.
I come across it, orange flavor. I really recommend you pick it up. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's true. I've never like actively settled on a style. So I end up kind of experimenting around. Like there's like through lines, I'm sure, through everything I draw that you might be able to pick up on. But yeah, it's something I think about a lot. Like
every... Yeah, the anime style too. And I'm like, oh, it's totally a different... Totally a different cartoonist.
No, so it's like, just me being totally a weirdo. A chameleon, I guess. Well, thank you. I'm flattered you grabbed a copy. Where should people go to check out your stuff?
My Instagram handle is at Keops Ibanez. That's KEOPS Ibanez, like the guitar, IBANEZ. And then, you know, better comic shops that are out there, New York City comic shops, you can check out Forbidden Planet in New York City. I think JHU had some copies a while ago. I don't know if they still have them. And if you're not in the New York City area, Chicago Comics has bought my stuff.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Comics Experience bought my stuff a while ago. I don't know if they still have them up. But I just got to plug the shops that do support independent creators. So yeah. If you guys are in those areas... Even if they don't have my stuff, you should all check it out for sure.
Sweet. Well, it was great meeting you. And now that I know you're close by, we should grab a coffee sometime.
Yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
It was great meeting you. Have a great
night. Likewise, man. Awesome.
Peace. Go to extremely.live/donate and give us some value. We give you value in this show. And if you got value out of it, send us some value in return by going to extremely.live/donate. It's a producer-driven enterprise, extremely.live. That means we don't have advertising. Therefore, you never have to listen to annoying advertising. And we can do whatever we want. We don't have to worry about anybody getting upset. And we can talk to all kinds of cool, weird, out there, and also more normal people. But yeah, extremely.live/donate. If you enjoyed what you heard, give us a little something in return. We'd appreciate it.